Welcome back. It's your guest host, Deb Hutton, with you until 6 o'clock. And right now, I'm joined by Matt Gurney, co-founder and editor of The Line, an online magazine. And also, he's a columnist for TV Ontario. And Aaron Morrison, a longtime political strategist and now principal at Morrison Comms. So we got some breaking news out of Ottawa. You will recall that we've spoken earlier this week about the fact that Pierre Poilievre had brought forward a motion to call on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to meet with all of the premiers and territorial leaders on the issue of carbon tax. Further to that, he wanted that meeting televised. He said it would be an ideas opportunity. Let the premier sort of support, the premiers plural, support the notion of alternatives to the Liberal government's carbon pricing. The news is that the New Democratic Party have said that carbon pricing is not the, quote, be-all, end-all when it comes to climate policy, and that they are open to alternative plans from the premiers, and therefore they are supporting this motion. This motion will pass. It is non-binding, but nonetheless, it will pass with both the support of the NDP and the Bloc. Matt Gurney, I'm going to start with you. Is this big news? Is it a big deal? As I said, it's non-binding. Are we seeing the first cracks in the NDP support of the Liberals? Give me your take on this.
I don't think it's a big deal in the sense, as you say, it's non-binding. But I do think it's interesting. And I guess I'm kind of maybe drawing a bit of an artificial distinction between interesting news and a big deal. I don't think anything's going to change because of this, but it gives us a couple of other tea leaves that we can sift through and read here. I think, like, the NDP position is, this is not even a political analysis. I think it's just a statement of the obvious. It's true. Like, there are other ways of trying to fight climate change. I kind of like the carbon tax. I'm kind of a weirdo on that one. But, like, it just, you know, as a matter of literal truth, there are other ways to go about this. So saying it's not the be-all, end-all, again, is literally true. But it does represent some messaging here, Deb. And I think it, you know, Aaron and I have been on these panels with each other for a while now. And a topic that we keep coming back to is how the Liberals have themselves compromised the politics of the carbon tax. Like, they have shot themselves in the foot, if I can introduce the metaphor there. So I guess the NDP is maybe reacting a little bit for that. The NDP might also be hoping to grab some of the votes the Liberals seem to be losing these days.
Aaron Morrison, what do you think of Matt's analysis?
All true, I would say. I think what's happening here is Jagmeet Singh has taken a stand and said, this is a fight between two parties who are both wrong. Having no climate change plan, no plan whatsoever. The only plan that Pierre Poilievre has is to axe the tax and do absolutely nothing about climate change. Whereas the only plan Justin Trudeau and the Liberals have is to keep a carbon tax in place, keep ramping it up, keep explaining to people incompetently again and again why it's okay to do that, and have no other components to their climate change plan. I think what Jagmeet Singh is saying is, enough, both of you, with this behavior. We need a real climate change plan, and we need a climate change plan that makes polluters pay, not drivers, not families living in homes, not everyday people.
And what about Matt's perspective that they may be trying to peel away some votes from the Liberals as they lose votes? Because we've not seen that in the polls, certainly, so far.
I think that's really insightful. And I think that's sort of what's been happening all along here. You've only seen a little bit of movement into the polls for all of the points that the Liberals lose. A lot of them go to the Conservatives because they're a known quantity. And a small number of them come over to the New Democrats as sort of like a, you know, a lesser known quantity. I think really what you're going to see is, as Canadians, if the trend continues, and who knows, a few months is a long time in politics. If the trend continues, Canadians really will have a choice. If they are done with Justin Trudeau and the Liberals, are they going to go to the Poilievre-style Conservatives, or do they want to go to a progressive option? So I think they, you know, in the end, this could be an election that really comes down to Liberal votes going orange or blue.
not an uncommon election scenario, by the way. We've seen it certainly in the province of Ontario and nationally before. We're going to stay with Ottawa for a minute here. I mentioned the Prime Minister is currently testifying. I can see him on my screen in the monitor. Have not been able to hear much of what he had to say, but he was asked, and we have a quick clip for you guys, he was asked about what should be done with the information around Handong. Handong, of course, a Toronto area MP, had been a Liberal and was part of some of the speculation around Chinese interference. Here's the Prime Minister this afternoon.
I asked Mr. Broadhurst whether CSIS was making any recommendations or suggestions as to what we should do with this information. And it was clear to Mr. Broadhurst that this was very much about just letting us know so that we know and could perhaps take any actions that we deemed appropriate, but they weren't going to be recommending for us to take action of one way or another. But they also specified that this was secret information that we could not share with the candidate in question, Mr. Dong, or the public at large.
Matt Gurney, what do you make of that quote from the Prime Minister on Handong? So essentially, we were given information that could be troubling. We were not given direction on how to deal with that. But you heard the Prime Minister pause a little bit, but certainly they wanted the Prime Minister to be aware. Mr. Broadhurst, who he speaks about, is one of his political team.
Information that is so tightly siloed, it cannot be shared, cannot be used, cannot be acted on, you might as well not have it. And this is a problem we have seen repeatedly with this government. And I don't think I mean that as a partisan swipe. I tend to suspect this is a bureaucratic or an institutional problem more than it is a partisan one. But we seem to have over-biased our institutions in this country to information compartmentalization and not information utilization. And this is something that just keeps coming up. We keep getting punched in the face by reality, and we're shocked by things that the rest of us saw coming a mile away. This is a problem, and I just don't mean foreign interference, Handong. I mean our inability to act on information is a problem. But there was a specific word the Prime Minister used there that I really want to underline. He said he asked Mr. Broadhurst if CSIS had a recommendation. Haven't we all spent months being lectured by very smart people that CSIS does not make policy recommendations? CSIS exists in an advisory role. It informs the government and leaves the decision-making to the executive branch here. I'm not trying to be pedantic on that, but I remember it wasn't all that long ago that we were being told it was not the place of CSIS to advise, it was the place of CSIS to inform. If the Prime Minister has gotten himself in a loop where he can only act on recommendations, but no recommendations are possible, that might kind of explain why we keep finding ourselves in these problems.
Well, and as I said, there's a bit of a pause there where he was trying to choose his words carefully in saying, you know, they weren't recommending, but they wanted us to have the information in case we wanted to act, which tells me everything you need to know, consistent with what you just said, which was he was being given that information for the purposes of making a choice about Handong.
I think, yeah, you know, look, I want to leave time for Aaron to get in here, but I do fundamentally think one of the things that has been coming out during this commission is that, first of all, there was a lot more going on than David Johnston had led us to believe, and that's something I think we're going to have a conversation about later.
Right.
But also, I honestly don't know what more this government would have needed to know before it felt like maybe it should do something.
Aaron Morrison?
Yeah, bingo. Right down to the fact that the Prime Minister did, in fact, receive a briefing about buses full of Chinese students, potentially with fake IDs, being sent by a foreign power to ensure Han Dong was nominated and ultimately elected. This is deeply troubling. The Prime Minister had multiple briefings on it. Karina Gould, who was the minister at the time, had apparently close to a dozen briefings on these matters, and they still chose not to take any action. And let's consider that also in the context of how stubbornly resistant the Prime Minister was to holding any type of public inquiry into foreign interference. I am finding this just stunning. If he did not know that he should have taken some action, he ought to have.
That's Aaron Morrison along with Matt Gurney, our smart speakers this afternoon. When we come back after the break, lots more happening, not just in Ottawa, but up at Queen's Park. Deb Hutton, your guest host this afternoon on The Rush. Welcome back. It's Deb Hutton, your guest host this afternoon with you for the next hour or so. And for the next 10 minutes, I'm joined by Matt Gurney, co-founder and editor of The Line, which is an online magazine. And Matt's also a columnist for TV Ontario. And Aaron Morrison, who is a longtime political strategist and now principal at Morris Comms. I said we would sort of stick with government-type things, but move away from Ottawa. We're going to go to Queen's Park now. The Ford government back in the fall announced that it would start including long-term care builds, so new long-term care beds or updated ones, in their efforts to build 1.5 million new homes by 2031. Part of that is enticing municipalities to be part of that. And there's incentives, financial incentives, which are important to municipalities if they in fact meet their targets, and even greater incentives if they exceed their targets. Well, it turns out four Ontario cities have been given millions because they exceeded their targets for building new housing in the last year. But the way they got there, statistics now show us, is because they included long-term care beds in their count. I am a full-on partisan. I support 90%, as I said earlier, of what the Ford government does around housing. But I disagree with this. Matt Gurney, does it matter?
Well, I don't know if it matters that you disagree with it. I don't know who they listen to. But I, for whatever this is worth, I agree with you. Look, talking about stupid things makes me sad. And this makes me sad because the idea of counting a long-term care bed, which is a staffed unit in a medical facility, as housing, is stupid. It just is. New families don't come to this country and move into a long-term care home. When I was 19 and finished OAC and I was taking those first brave steps out into adulthood, I did not pack a few cardboard boxes into my trunk and go move into my new bed in a long-term care facility. It's not housing. It's a medical ward. I actually am sympathetic in some ways to the fact that the Ford government wants to count student housing towards housing starts. That makes some sense. I think we probably have to think about that for a bit, but I'm not reflexively hostile to the idea. Long-term care beds being counted as housing is like counting prison cells and jail cells toward housing. It's dumb. It hurts my head. It makes me sad.
So a couple of things before we move on to Aaron. One, I didn't mean does it matter that I feel that way. I meant does it matter that we are calculating this and giving municipalities more money, just to be clear.
But on your feelings matter to me.
Thank you so much, Matt. Probably to no one else. But the second part I of what you said, I also fully agree with. I actually think retirement homes should be counted. I do think student housing should be counted. Those two make sense for me because you can choose to be in a retirement home and get some supports or to continue to live at home and get some supports. And if you don't live at home, you are moved to a retirement home, you're freeing up housing for someone else. Same with student housing. When we have such a crunch because of the vast number of students in this country, it should count. Aaron Morrison, after my little disclaimer there, what's your thought on this?
Well, I mean, look, it is Ford putting his thumb on the scale. It's Doug Ford cooking the books. And I can agree with you on retirement housing. That is a place that people can choose to live. They may be able to continue to live with their spouse and live relatively independently. There's a lot of different types of retirement homes. But ultimately, student housing, no, as Matt says, no new Canadian is moving to Canada and moving their entire family into a dorm room. And those dorm rooms are empty in July and August, and we still need to have a home for the people that were living there in September and October. So, and here's the problem. Here's why this matters. It shows that Doug Ford is not taking the housing crisis seriously. He either doesn't know or doesn't really care that young people are putting off having a baby they desperately want because they can't afford a place with two bedrooms. Adults are living in mom's basement long after mom would like them to move out because they can't afford to live independently. And seniors are becoming homeless. These are real life ruining housing prices. And, you know, handing out novelty checks and cooking the books to make it look like you're doing better than you are just shows that you are not taking seriously how deeply this is impacting people's lives.
Man, I'd love to refute so much of what you said, Aaron, but I will not jump out of the host chair and into the panelist chair. This is the hard part for me. I'm really curious for your take on this particular issue. UK has for some time had small sporadic penalties for families who took their kids out of school largely for vacation purposes, who weren't sick, and they've had small fines. They've announced a national framework, and they've increased any of the fines that were being given out by 33% beginning in August of this year. If your child is out of school for more than 5 days on what they call unauthorized school absence, you're going to get a fine. You're allowed 2 fines in any 3-year period, which isn't that many. And once you've reached that 2 fines in a 3-year period, other action's going to be taken, including heading to the courts, what they call a parental order or prosecution that could include some jail time. Matt Gurney, I've always railed, as I think you know, and I recognize your wife's a teacher, on teacher absences, more recently on principal absences. I've never thought about fining parents for student absences.
There's a role for the intervention of the state, and teachers are an important frontline defense in this, where there are issues of neglect, when there are issues of abandonment, when there are issues of abuse. This is something, and again, yes, you're right, I am married to a teacher. Teachers are trained to look for these things, and they're an important part of the defense system on that. But what is being proposed by the United Kingdom there would have me in court inside 2 years entirely because of my son's hockey schedule, which includes out-of-town tournaments. So if I were to be fined on this, I would pay the fine, and I wish you two fine ladies could see the gesture I am making right now that I would include as I paid the fine. This is ridiculous. Let's not confuse a kid with an active athletic schedule or a kid that misses some time visiting family overseas with an actual case of parental neglect. They're different things. Let's not pretend we can't understand the difference.
So, Aaron, I'm going to take some calls on this later in the show, and I will say freely, I haven't landed on how I feel about this yet. Your take on it. Convince me one way or another.
I would like to convince you that this is a terrible idea.
Okay.
I think that in the case that you have parental neglect, that is a time for teachers, for social workers, for caring adults to sort out how to best care for the kid. And a fine is not likely to do that. And let's be honest, who's the least likely to pay their fines? Probably the same people who are likely to neglect their kids. So the people who will actually end up being fined are parents of high achieving athletic students, or parents who are going through a real crisis, like a serious illness in the family. Parents of kids who are disrupted for other reasons, like, having to go overseas to see family or something of that nature. I think this just misses the target by a country mile.
Well, we are going to take some more calls and opinions on that later in the show. Matt Gurney, co-founder and editor of The Line, an online magazine and columnist for TV Ontario, and Aaron Morrison, longtime political strategist and now principal at Morrison Comms. Thanks to both of you for a thoughtful conversation this afternoon on our Smart Speakers panel.
Thank you.
Thanks, Deb.
Coming up after the break, as I said, I'm going to take your calls a little bit later in the program. Peter McKay, former foreign affairs minister, is going to join me, and we'll talk about the latest testimony by the prime minister into the foreign interference inquiry this afternoon. Stay with us.